Hey guys, welcome to what we're going to call the history of FMW. This is going to be episode one. I have no idea how many episodes there will be, but with Onita retiring, I think there will be a definite final episode. And speaking of which, FMW appears to begin and end with Onita. So if you're going to tell the history of FMW, I think you kind of have to start with the history of Onita himself. So this first episode is pretty much all going to be Onita pre-FMW. For anyone who doesn't know, Onita originally was an All Japan rookie. Onita joined the Federation in 1973, but before that, I'm joined by, of course, Bahu FMW. You can find him at bahufmw.com, FMW World. I'm sorry, FMWWrestling.us. I'm sorry about that. And he's going to be our Onita historian for the day. Brett, what can you tell us about Onita before joining AJPW?
So he ended up, as a young boy, he lived with his parents, and his father, they worked in kind of selling cloth and everything in Japan. And then his father died early on, like when he was like 13, 14 or so, and they needed money to support themselves. So he dropped out of high school and joined the All Japan Dojo, which had just been created. All Japan had just been created in 1972, and they opened the dojo in 1973. So he was actually the first student that enrolled into the dojo. And so pretty much he started wrestling to make money for him and his mother.
Well, I didn't know any of that. That's cool, man. And do you know who were his influences when he got started?
Terry Funk, pretty much. I mean, I would imagine also Giant Baba, just because that's who the whole, you know, he was such a superstar and everything. But I know Onita really looked up to Terry Funk even before before he even was a wrestler. And Terry Funk was super popular throughout Japan during that time as well.
Of course, and the Onita-Terry Funk relationship will carry on for a long, long time, as we'll see going forward. Onita began training in 1973, and he debuted the following year. What career highlights were there in those first few years?
So pretty much he was just a preliminary wrestler, just a green boy. He was Giant Baba's attendant. He pretty much first 3-4 years just worked opening matches with Masafuchi, who's still working in All Japan today. And he was actually the number two person to graduate from the dojo. And they pretty much just worked opening style matches for about 3-4 years throughout the 70s even.
And they always talk now at what point did Onita become the All Japan junior star that most people kind of think of him as pre-FMW?
It wasn't actually until he came back from America. Well, from North America, he came back, and then they kind of started giving him a push and everything as the junior heavyweight. So around 1982, 1983, that's the time period. So he was, 8-9 years into his career by the time he actually got a push in All Japan with any type of, character or whatnot, which was, top junior heavyweight in the division.
And not to jump around too much, but Onita went to the U.S. in 1981. What can you tell us about his excursion during that time period?
So he originally went to the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico. That was his first day. Him and Masafuchi, they were kind of sent off and everything, and started in Puerto Rico, went to the Dominican Republic. Well, in the Dominican Republic, what happened was the promoter wanted Onita to lose to their top star in a 2-out-of-3-falls match two straight times. Onita refused to do this, and during the match, he actually stiffed the wrestler he was wrestling, who was the top star of the promotion. And so when he got back to the locker room, the promoter pretty much had four wrestlers jump him, and they beat the hell out of Onita. And they locked Masafuchi out the room so he couldn't help him, and they just beat the hell out of him for a good 30, 40 minutes or so until they just got tired of beating him up. So Onita was badly beaten up. He called Terry Funk And him and Masafuchi went over to Amarillo, where, and Onita stayed in Terry Funk's ranch during that time period. And he recovered and lived with Terry Funk for about a year or so. And Terry Funk got him actually booked in San Antonio. And then he ended up, Terry Funk was actually the one that got him over to Memphis. And that's when Onita, that's kind of what most people know Onita in during his U.S. stay was while in Memphis. And so that's when him and Masafuchi, they kind of had a stereotypical Japanese gimmick. He was Mr. Onita, Mr. Fuchi. And pretty much the highlight most people know of Onita in Memphis was having the second Tupelo concession brawl. There had already been one before that was super famous. And they had another one in 1981. And that was with Ricky Morton and Eddie Gilbert, where they pretty much just had this wild brawl in the concession stand of Tupelo, and just were throwing everything, something that no one was seeing back then in 1981. And, you know, that's kind of what Memphis was known for, just this wild brawl, you know, weapons and everything like that. So that's what Onita is mostly known for. And then he ended up through Giant Baba and all that. He ended up going to the Carolinas, and he faced the likes of Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat, and all, because All Japan had a kind of a deal with Mid-Atlantic NWA promotions back then.
Awesome. And what other, even if he didn't participate in them, what other type of gimmick matches did he see during this time period?
Yeah, like I mentioned, he saw the wild, crazy brawling in Memphis. He also saw the barbed wire in Puerto Rico, and he saw the blood and everything like that. And he ended up integrating that in his style of wrestling, you know, a decade later. But he ended up learning, the barbed wire style in Puerto Rico, and while in Memphis, kind of that hard hitting, wild brawling all over the place style. So he kind of integrated both of those into FMW. In the 90s.
Now, just kind of curious, at this time period, 1981, 82, what is the feeling about blood and weapons in the Japanese wrestling culture?
So, in around the early 80s or so, New Japan was number one. It was the top promotion. They had just created Tiger Mask, who was a big time draw, big time crowds loved him, the style, everything was just brand new. So All Japan countered with blood, actually, by during a match with Abdul the Butcher. He ended up using his fork on Terry Funk, and Terry Funk bled like crazy, which nobody had really seen in Japan at the time. So that was brand new. So All Japan kind of brought this new style, you know, just bleeding and, you know, kind of the shock and awe of, you know, of kind of losing my train of thought, sorry, kind of the shock and awe of using the blood and everything in the matches.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of those matches, and it's weird to think of what, you know, for me, AJPW got famous with Kawada, Misawa, Taue, and then you go back 15 years, and it's a lot of forks and blood and brawling. It's very different, for sure. Just a final side note about this. Do you know what was the television standards back then? Because I know that there was matches where Freddie Blassie came over, and he would be biting people, and there'd be blood. And people in the audience would be screaming. The television crews didn't know if they should be filming it. Was there any apprehension from the television stations?
I don't believe so. That was kind of the main thing that they were highlighting with the promotion and whatnot. Now, they didn't do it all the time. It wasn't a, you know, everyday thing like FMW developed or, you know, other promotions like the deathmatch promotions do today. So it wasn't an everyday thing, but it was kind of what got them popular, kind of kept them afloat because they were struggling up against New Japan and whatnot. But they're, those kind of the matches, they usually only showed the main events on TV and everything, and those were the main events. So they, at the time, it was okay.
Great. In 1982, Onita returns to All Japan. What type of push is he now going to get after coming back?
So he kind of was put into the middle right there. Like I said, he was the junior heavyweight, the top of the division, and so he was kind of going to be known as the worker. Like, and he was the counter to New Japan's Tiger Mask, and so he was having pretty good matches for the time and everything, just to, you know, kind of stand out as for his work rate for his high flying style, which again it was nothing compared to Tiger Mask, but it was kind of All Japan's counter to it. And so pretty much a good mid-card position. He had his feuds, but he wasn't the main event ever or anything like that.
Okay. And, I'll be honest, I've never actually seen these matches, but they're pretty famous. What innovative parts of the matches would you think, came about at that time period? Like, was Onita a high flyer or was he kind of a ground-based junior?
No, he was a high flyer. He was doing planchas and topes, things like that, which, you know, they had been done, you know, and everything, like Mil Mascaris and whatnot had been doing them, you know, in the 70s. But he was bringing them to, you know, a different set of audience and everything, and kind of, like I said, it was kind of a counter to New Japan's Tiger Mask, but it wasn't at the level of what Tiger Mask was doing.
Okay, cool. And the next big stop on the train would be the Chavo Guerrero feud, which is what I probably know most about Onita because there's the most video footage of it online that's easy to access. Do you want to go over the Chavo feud and the famous tournament final?
So pretty much Chavo Guerrero was working for Mid-Atlantic, and like I said, they had All Japan and Mid-Atlantic had brokered a deal, and you know, Onita and Giant Baba, they had gone to the Carolinas, and in return, the Guerreros, Hector and Chavo Senior, would come by to Japan and tour with All Japan. And so Onita had a match where he defeated Chavo Guerrero Senior, and he was awarded the trophy, at the time and still today, you know, after winning a championship, you're awarded a trophy. So he was given the trophy, and Chavo Guerrero, shook his hand and then back suplexed him, and then began took the trophy and then began smashing it up against Onita's leg, which caused, you know, a lot of blood and just blood everywhere and everything like that, which was kind of like the very first Onita blade job, pretty much.
And at this time, was this angle still shocking, or was it kind of par for the course?
It was still shocking. It was still something that they didn't expect. You know, blood, like I mentioned, you know, the Terry Funk, Abdullah the Butcher thing had happened, so blood existed. But still, at the time, seeing, you know, even just a mid-card guy, and, you know, and the way, the style it happened, you know, his leg was cut up. You know, it wasn't just the forehead, or it wasn't just the fork to the arm. You know, his leg was bleeding, you know, profusely. So it was something different, even though it wasn't the first, you know, time that the audience had seen blood or anything like that.
Yeah, for those who haven't seen it, it's a prolonged beatdown. I mean, it goes on for quite a while. There's bells ringing, people are running in, there's blood all over. He breaks Chavo breaks the trophy. It's even nowadays, if they were to do this on television now, it would be a pretty eye-catching angle for sure. It's very cool. For anyone who doesn't know, I'm going on Bahu's site. He has a history of FMW kind of, so I'm kind of using that as my guide. The next stop would be his knee injury. Is there anything that you want to go over between the Chavo feud and this knee injury that happens?
Well, a lot of people confuse the two, because a lot of people see the gruesome injury and just kind of relate to, oh, that's what he messed up his knee. Well, it was actually about a year later. Onita was coming out of the ring, kind of like how the Rockers in WWF used to do, where like they kind of have one hand up against the apron and kind of pulled themselves out of the ring. Well, he did that, and that was his signature, exit of the ring back then. And he did that and ended up slipping on some water on the mat. Someone had spilt water on the little blue mat around ringside. And he fell and busted his knee up really bad, tore some cartilage. It was really bad. Like it was pretty much it pretty much ended his career at the time. And he was so upset because He was supposed to get a big push. He was supposed to get a push into the main event as a main event type person with All Japan at this point, because he had he had the talent, he had good matches and everything, and you know he'd been in this, the promotion for about 10 years or so, and Giant Baba was finally gonna give him that push. And right around that time, his knee was so bad. It took him about a year to recover for him to actually try a match. And then he had a match. He was not a good worker anymore. He was slow. He just had not fully recovered. And Giant Baba let him go pretty much and just said, I can't have you wrestle anymore. And so pretty much Onita was forced to retire at this time and walk away from wrestling. Because at the time, there was only New Japan and All Japan, and he wasn't going to go to New Japan. So it was just leave the business at that time.
Wow, I didn't know any of that. There were, back in the early days of the internet, there was a clip of him coming off the top rope, and everyone said that that was where his knee injury happened. But it's usually the small stuff that causes the injuries. So what year would it have been when he officially retired the first time?
January of 1985. So, like I said, he had a match in he came back in December 1984, and it just wasn't working out. And I mean, so they only gave him about a month to try and recover from the injury, and what they saw they didn't like, and they pretty much Baba let him go. So, January 1985, he was out of the business.
You might not know the answer to this, but did Onita bow out gracefully, or did he kind of fight it?
I think it was just kind of one of those, you can't do anything about it, because he had, just the way the Japanese are, where, Giant Baba had just so much respect to, even to this day, Onita talks, with such respect to about Giant Baba. So it's just one of those, he makes the rules, he makes the decisions, I got to go with it.
All right, cool. And so in this time period, there's a pretty famous story that post-retirement, Onita spent some time in jail. Is this true, or is this just rumor?
It is true. I do know that. Now, the reasoning why I'm not 100% clear on, I have heard in the past it was over taxes. I know that Onita was very into trying to get as much money as possible, he'd scam people and stuff like that. He had a lot of get-rich schemes. He actually tried, and when he was living with Terry Funk, he was trying to get sell wireless telephones and everything, which, obviously would turn into cell phones, and everything. But he was trying to promote that and everything in the 80s. So he had a lot of put some money in here, get rich quick kind of things, kind of schemes and whatnot. So I do know that was, he also had a lot of financial issues after he retired. And like I said, the rumor I had heard was over taxes, but I'm not 100% sure about that.
This doesn't sound, I don't know. Have you seen the prices for the Onita retirement show?
I think $200 for front row seats, and then like $100, and then like $60 and $50.
Yeah, I'm not too much has changed. I was actually planning on possibly going to that, but I think they kind of priced me out with the ticket prices. Sad but true.
Well, he wanted the show to happen at Kawasaki Stadium. It right now is a football stadium, and he tried and tried so badly to have an exploding match for his retirement, but Kawasaki Stadium is now, like I said, a football stadium, and it was the retirement is going to be in October, so he could not get a scheduled event for the show. So he had to go to Corrigan Hall and a much smaller building. So he wants to make as much money off of his retirement as possible. So he priced the heck out of those tickets.
Yeah, I wish him luck in selling him out. I really wish I could be there, but the numbers don't add up for me. So, I wish him luck. Do you just curious? Do you think he would sell out a stadium at this point?
I think. Well, Kawasaki's a lot smaller is the thing. It's not the 50,000 seat stadium that it used to be. It's a different stadium. They pretty much tore it down and rebuilt it. And I actually went there in 2011. It's pretty much, it's a little bit bigger than a high school football stadium. So it probably fits about 12,000 people. So, I mean, I think with the proper stipulation, and I've actually heard rumors, you know, he hasn't, nothing's been officially announced. The match, and I don't think it would have happened at Kawasaki Stadium, but the rumor is that he'll be taking on Terry Funk if Terry Funk can go at 75. But I think that if it was Kawasaki Stadium and the explosions and all that, I mean, I think he could get 8,000 to 10,000 people.
This changes everything. I might have to go to this now. So, well, okay. So during this time period, he retired in 1985, and he didn't actually show back up for a couple of years. What did, besides the famous scandal with him going to jail, what else did he do during this time of note?
He started doing construction, and he actually made decent money during that time period. So right after wrestling, he actually wasn't struggling financially, but he ended up falling while doing construction. And with his bad knee, he couldn't do it anymore. And then that's when he kind of was just jobless, and all the money issues took place and everything, and then the jail incident and everything. After he got out of jail, then he ended up training for JWP, which is an old women's promotion. And he was a trainer there around 87, 88. And then kind of being around the wrestlers and all that, just he kind of got that feeling, I want to come back.
Cool. And so now, according to your site, I'm going off of your site's history, he first appears at the Pioneer Sensei Wrestling promotion. What is this? I've never actually heard of this.
So Ryuma Go, who was an old All Japan wrestler during the time period of Onita, he had started up the very first, the first independent promotion, or a small independent wrestling promotion in Japan. There was IWE, which was an old promotion in the 70s, but that was a much bigger promotion. It was kind of like the number three. This was Pioneer Sensei was a much, much smaller number three. And I mean, pretty much just kind of like, you know, a small little independent compared to WWF, WCW. There was no actual competition. It was just another promotion that was just created. And it was just, it was Ryuma Go's, way of, I can't work in All Japan anymore. I got let go from, and New Japan, I'm not going to make it in New Japan. I'm going to start my own independent promotion. So it was kind of like that, where it was a way to get him, to keep him working and whatnot. So he had created his own, which, at the time, like I said, with Onita and other wrestlers, once they got let go from their other promotion, unless they were a main star like Stan Hansen or someone like that, they weren't going to flip-flop promotions. They were just going to have to leave the business pretty much.
And what was the state of independent wrestling in Japan at this time? I mean, was there television to be on? Were they selling tapes? Like, what type of crowds did they draw?
Not too much, actually. Yeah, no TV, nothing like that. I think they hired people in the crowd to videotape, because there are some handheld videos of Pioneer Sensei around this time period. So there would be some kind of circulation, kind of like, tape traders in the 90s and whatnot, except not really, not from television. Pioneer Sensei was not a successful promotion by any means. Like I said, it was a very small promotion that Ryuma Go at the time just wanted to keep working. So nothing over 1,000 or anything like that.
Final question, what type of style did they employ? Was it a pre-UWF kind of shoot style?
No, it was just pretty much just a standard basic. I mean, there really was no style to the promotion. It was just matches. Okay. Just regular matches that you would see. Nothing great, nothing you need to go out in your way to see or anything like that. It literally was just a way for people to wrestle and people to make money as an alternative to New Japan, All Japan. But it never really caught on, because it only ended up lasting about a year or so.
Oh, okay. I got you. Okay. And what was the reaction for Onita coming back? Did nobody really care? Was it kind of a ballyhooed thing?
Yeah, no, it wasn't looked down upon, because I think at the time, you know, it wasn't like he had promoted, or it wasn't like there was this big, you know, retirement tour or anything like that, like he later had with FMW. It was just kind of one of those, you know, hey, I had to leave and now I'm back. And, you know, like Terry Funk and whatnot had, you know, already came back from retirements and much bigger promoted type, you know, gimmicks and ways to make money. You know, when Onita retired, it was literally just to leave the business. It wasn't to let me have this retirement match and make all this money or whatnot. It was just so the fans didn't feel duped or anything like that. And it was just Onita, you know, wanted to, you know, he was struggling financially. He still had that itch for the pro wrestling business.
Great. And this would have been in what time period? 1988?
Yeah, 1988 is when he came back.
Okay, great. Now, the following year, I'm guessing after this Pioneer Sensei kind of folded, Onita would show up at some UWF shows to, as now we would call it, shoot his own angle, kind of. Can you go over that?
Yeah, so UWF was really popular at the time in the late 80s. It was a shoot-style promotion that no one had really seen. You know, it was kind of the counter to New Japan, All Japan, and their worked matches. You know, this was a shoot-style promotion and everything. And around this time, this is when Onita really kind of started to make his name because, you know, no, it wasn't like in the in 87, 88, or when he did wrestle the Pioneer Sensei match. It wasn't like people were clamoring for Onita. It wasn't like he had, you know, a following or anything like that. It was just kind of like, oh, that's that junior heavyweight from 5 years ago. So, but when he shot his own angle, pretty much he challenged UWF. He wanted to have a match with UWF. And he went to the building to shoot his own angle. He went to the building and everything. And they told him, you can't come in. You don't have a ticket. Go away. And so that kind of caught some media attention and whatnot that UWF was not answering Onita's challenge. Like, and, you know, it was kind of the, you know, UWF is scared of Onita type angle that was going on. And, you know, it kind of caught on. And that's actually the first time that Onita began drawing some attention because the media was picking up on it.
And he would continue to do this. I mean, you tell me he, you know, when he wasn't wrestling, he was kind of trying to get into get-rich-quick schemes. It's very similar here, and I think it makes him sound awesome. He really is the wild thing. Where did this UWF feud lead?
So it ended up not really – it resulted in the beginning of FMW, but had nothing really to do with UWF because after that, nothing really folded until about 25 years later, until like last year, but that's a whole different story. But essentially what happened was Onita contacted the World Karate Association, which was a karate promotion in Japan, and a match was scheduled with Masashi Oyagi, who's the top karate expert in the promotion and whatnot. And Onita challenged him to a karate match to kind of show that, hey, look, UWF, I can wrestle shoot style. Look at me. I can take on one of the top, legit fighters in the country. And so they had a karate style match that Onita ended up getting disqualified in for using pro wrestling moves. He kind of just, you know, he was losing and everything. And then he just ended up, started using back suplexes and whatnot and got DQ'd. And so after that, then, the feud with Oyagi continued, but Onita, you know, said, I want to have a mixture of pro wrestling and martial arts, and I want Oyagi to come, you know, and fight me in that kind of style. So that's when he got with some of Weekly Gong publishers, Wally Yamaguchi, who ended up being in WWE for a brief second in 1998, as well as Miki Ibaragi, he got with them and they pretty much created Frontier Martial Arts Wrestling. And that's where the martial arts comes in from, was that it originally was a mixture of wrestling and martial arts so that he could challenge Oyagi to kind of that mixed style of match.
There's actually there's a video game from, I think, 1992. It's an FMW video game and it's more like a Street Fighter style karate fighter. And I'm sure it takes back from those first influences, but it was weird as a kid picking up an FMW game and there's no explosion barbed wire matches. Yeah. It was just a bit strange for me. Real quick, these matches with Aoyagi, were they works? Were they shoots? Like, how did these matches work?
They were worked matches. There was everything was planned. You know, so pretty much the first match was in Nagoya, where Aoyagi is from. So it's the first match was pretty much Aoyagi just beating the hell out of Onita and Onita fighting back. But at the end, him just taking so much punishment that I believe Tarzan Goto, threw in the towel. And Aoyagi won the match. You know, so it was all planned and everything. And then they came back 4 days later at Corican Hall and had another match. And Onita, you know, again, took a beating and everything. He's taking all these hard kicks and whatnot. And so it was a hard style of match, but they were worked finishes and everything. And Onita ended up winning with a Thunderfire powerbomb to finally defeat Aoyagi.
Awesome. And so at this point, do you know the date of this final match?
The final match was at Corrigan Hall. It was October 10th, 1989.
Okay, and was that under the World Karate banner?
No, they were both under FMW. So okay. The Nagoya show and the Corrigan Hall show were under FMW. They're the first two FMW shows, and they were so successful that they knew they had something after this. If both shows had bombed, they would have just folded right there. But they both did really well. And so after that, they decided we gotta turn this into something else. We gotta tour with this. There's more money to be made with this.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a good place to stop as far as the timeline goes. When we come back, we'll start doing the year by year analysis of the FMW business and angles and stars. But since we have some time left, I was wondering if we could go over some of the pre-history of some people who would go on to become mainstays with FMW as it went on. First, can you tell me who were the business partners that came together to create FMW? Like, where did the funding come from and all of that stuff?
So FMW started as a very, you know, poor promotion and everything. They were working off of, you know, just a couple hundred dollars and everything. So, like I said, he got with Mickey Ibaragi, and he got with Wally Yamaguchi, and just kind of they all ended up funding it through sponsors and everything like that. And I think the World Karate Association, you know, put some money into it as well and everything. So it was very, you know, kind of a you know, kind of everyone came together to get those two shows, you know, through. And once those two shows were successful, then they kind of had money to play with and begin to kind of focus on future shows and whatnot.
All right, cool. A few more names just to go over. One name that I was always a big fan of would be Tarzan Goto, who would not only be a big part of the early FMW deathmatch boom, but he would go on to be part of IWA and such. What was Tarzan Goto like before, you know, in this pre-FMW 1980 period?
So Goto had kind of a similar beginning as Onita. He started off in All Japan a little after Onita, like 81, 82-ish or so, and kind of went through the system and everything like that. And then he was sent off to America around 85, 86 or so to tour and whatnot. He went to Memphis and he went to Florida. You know, so he lived in America for several years. And by the time he was pretty much somewhere during that time period where he was in America, All Japan was no longer interested in him and let him go. And so he pretty much just had to continue working in America and whatnot and just making ends meet and whatnot. And so in 89, when Onita started FMW, he contacted Goto, kind of feeling like he has, you know, he's a big guy. He can be a good number two. He'll work cheap, you know, and he had a relationship with him.
Cool. And you obviously can't talk about Onita without talking about the recently passed Mr. Pogo. Mr. Pogo would go on to be probably Onita's greatest rival. He went on to be part of the big deathmatch boom of the 90s with Wing, IWA, BJW, and a few other smaller promotions. What was Mr. Pogo's history?
So he pretty much started off as a sumo wrestler, and then he, you know, he was such a popular sumo wrestler, and he got he was pretty much recruited to the New Japan Dojo, and Mr. Pogo is one of the very first New Japan dojo graduates in 72. And so he worked, but he was not a good worker at all, though. He only had a couple matches in New Japan in 72. And then he was sent off to the he was sent off to North America. And he went everywhere. He went to started in Calgary, went to California, went to Texas, went to Kansas City, went to Florida, went to the Carolinas, came back to Calgary, worked Vancouver. So he worked all over North America before working in finally finding a spot in Puerto Rico for the last bit of the 80s and whatnot. And he pretty much lived in Puerto Rico the last 3 years and everything when Onita reached out to him, you know, to be the number one heel. He actually was flying to Puerto Rico because he was making such, he had developed, you know, he had a family there and whatnot. So, you know, had a permanent job in Puerto Rico. But when Onita came calling and, you know, and he kept getting brought back and whatnot, then Mr. Pogo pretty much became a full-time FMW wrestler.
Cool. And the last deathmatch pioneer on this list would be Mitsuhiro Matsunaga, who would go on to be Mr. Danger, and he would participate in most of the big Japan freak show deathmatches that I think most people have seen at least clips of. And he's all over the first couple dozen FMW shows. What was he like before becoming the Mr. Danger?
So he was a student to Oyagi with the World Karate Association. So Matsunaga had actually started off learning karate. And so when he started working with FMW in 89, those matches were through Oyagi, the FMW World Karate Association relationship that they had at the time. And him and actually Jerry Flynn from WCW, you know, they had a match with Onita and Goto and everything like that with the in FMW. And then after that, the World Karate Association kind of pulled away from FMW. And pretty much Matsunaga just worked, you know, just was a karate fighter and whatnot up until Wing started up in 91. So and then he ended up becoming the face of the promotion there. And that's where, you know, they had a kind of a different style of than FMW. They had more, you know, fire and whatnot. And you know, but he ended up becoming really popular and the number one face for Wink.
Have you ever been to his the Mr. Danger Steakhouse?
Yeah, I went one time in 2010.
Cool. I don't eat meat, so I haven't been, but it's like I need to go. I need to just suck it up and have some french fries and just go.
Yeah, he's usually there. Like when I went there, because I always wonder, because there's actually two of them now because it's such a popular establishment. But, I mean, when I went there, he was there. And every time I see people go there, he's always there. So, and he was there even when he was still wrestling and whatnot. So it's been around for 20 years or so.
Yeah. Going beyond the whole deathmatch brawling, there were one guy that was a big part of the FMW scene was definitely Ricky Fuji. Ricky Fuji was, until Hayabusa, he was probably the light heavyweight star. Where did Ricky Fuji come from?
So Ricky Fuji started in the New Japan Dojo in the late 80s. He came along up with Shinya Hashimoto. And he around this time period, the late 80s, decided he didn't want to be a pro wrestler anymore. He wanted to be a UWF fighter. And so he decided he just left the New Japan Dojo one day. He just decided he was done with wrestling. He flew to Florida. Because he had heard that Frank Gotch, who was kind of known as the top, you know, shoot fighter, and he could be, you know, train him and everything. He went to Tampa to go be trained by Frank Gotch. Problem was, he goes to Florida, and nobody knows who Frank Gotch is. He kind of misunderestimated the popularity of Frank Gotch, you know, in the late 80s. So he goes to a taxi cab at the airport and goes, take me to Frank Gotch's. Taxi driver has no idea what he's talking about. So the taxi drivers end up getting together trying to help him, and it turns out that one of them is Pat Tanaka's father working as a taxi driver. And so he gets Pat Tanaka in contact with Ricky Fuji. Ricky Fuji stays with Pat Tanaka in Florida, and he's right next door to Florida Championship Wrestling, Dusty Rhodes and all that. He sees all this wrestling going on. He goes, you know what? I want to do that again. You know, that's so awesome, you know, all this, you know, seeing this different style of wrestling. So then he ends up flying to Calgary to work with the Hart brothers. He, you know, there's such a good reputation with the Hart brothers school at the time. He flies up to Canada. He trains there. He has his first match with Ross Hart in 88. And then he ends up getting a better deal with the rival Vancouver promotion and begins working as kind of like a Tiger Mask ripoff and everything like that about 89 until FMW contacts him and he ends up accepting the offer to go back to Japan and begin working with FMW as the junior heavyweight.
Cool. And just as FMW wanted to solidify a light heavyweight division, during the 90s, women's wrestling in Japan was huge, and they even had kind of a thriving women's division, and it was led by Megumi Kudo. Where did she come from?
So she started up in All Japan Women's Promotion. She, you know, like many girls at the time with the Crush Girls being so popular, wanted to be a wrestler. So she started wrestling at 16. You know, she went to the dojo at 16 or so and worked the, you know, lived the dojo life and everything. And she, you know, made her debut in 1986 and she wrestled, but, you know, at that time the skill level was so high and, you know, so many famous wrestlers that she trained with, you know, came from that, even her graduating class of 86, you know, Aja Kong was there. Bull Nakano was already there. So there was already all these great elite workers that she didn't stand out. And so they let her go after about a year or so. And she ended up taking a job as a kindergarten aide, you know, helping the teacher out and everything like that with all the kids and everything. And so she did that for about a year or so up until 1990 when Onita wanted to start with FMW. He wanted to start his own women's division. You know, it was something different. He didn't have enough wrestlers to kind of fill out a card, so this was going to be something different in Japan, having a women's division in a men's promotion. So he already had had some women's wrestlers in the dojo, like Shark Tashaya and Crusher Domori. And he also had some foreigners and whatnot, like Jacqueline from WWF was worked a tour and whatnot. But he wanted some, you know, top. He wanted to bring three former All Japan women's dojo wrestlers, which were Megumi Kudo, Combat Toyota, and Raiban Amada. Those three, you know, had the same, you know, story as Kudo, where they were, you know, pretty much just after about a year or two, All Japan Women's let them go. And so he brought them in to kind of have somewhat of a roster because, like, the other names I had mentioned, they were not good workers. You know, they were green, and, I mean, they never ended up even really being good workers. So he wanted to actually pretty much have a legitimate division and have, you know, average to good matches at the very least.
Sorry, my mic was muted.
Okay.
Going on, if you go, just to cover the foreigners real quickly as we kind of wrap up here, if you go through the first year of cards, one name that you see a lot that I don't really know anything about him is Jos LeDuc.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, he was a Montreal wrestler. You know, he pretty much just was a 1970s territorial wrestler. You know, wrestled in Montreal. He wrestled in AWA. He wrestled in NWA. He wrestled in WWF in 80, around 87 or so, and just mid-card matches and whatnot. Kind of a big, burly, you know, kind of think of Ox Baker type style. You know, bearded, bald man and whatnot. You know, so just kind of a brawler and but not necessarily like a good worker or anything.
And the final wrestler to talk about would be the Gladiator Mike Awesome. He would go on to have a lot of success in ECW. He would be in the dying days of WCW, but and he even had a short run during the Invasion angle in WWE WWF. What launched him to the main stage where he became one of the first big foreign stars of the early days of FMW?
So, like I mentioned, Tarzan Goto had worked Memphis and Florida in the late 80s, and he actually worked with Mike Awesome. So, but actually the story is that Tarzan Goto, you know, was working Florida and everything, and they wanted to have a big, giant, you know, monster Gaijin, you know, work against Onita. So they actually first tried to contact Al Green, who ended up working for WCW and everything, and that didn't, you know, they were going to come up, they came up with the Gladiator gimmick and everything like that for him. He ended up pulling out at the last minute. So then Tarzan Goto reached out to Mike Awesome, who, like I said, he had worked against Tarzan Goto in Florida and everything, and so they brought him in to just be this monster Gaijin, you know, work against Onita at the end of the tour. Onita beat him, and that probably be it for him. But he got so over, he had a good, you know, work rate, he got popular. You know, they ended up bringing him back, and then just kept bringing him back for years and years and years.
And I would say his matches with Hayabusa are easily some of the top five highlight matches. You know, I was a big fan of Mike Awesome, he had a very tragic end, like a lot of people in the business. But the final name I just want to talk about, he's kind of like the background godfather of the company, would be Shoichi Rai. Who was he? Where did he come from? And what was his position inside the company?
So pretty much he was just a big fan. You know, he had grown up being a big wrestling fan his whole life, and then he saw in the magazines FMW was hiring. You know, before they had started, they were advertising for positions and whatnot. So Arai went to an interview where he Onita and all that were watching, and you know, he to be a ring announcer. So Arai, you know, started. Rai stood out. His voice was very, he could kind of have a high pitch and everything like that. You know, put a lot of passion into his voice, and Onita hired him to be ring announcer. And so he started off as a ring announcer, and as the years went by, he pretty much started working with the office. He ended up becoming vice president while Onita was in charge of FMW. And then when Onita ended up selling FMW, he sold it to Arai, who was the owner to FMW until the very end.
Great. And if anybody wants to read it on Bahu's site, he has an excerpt from Arai's autobiography where he talks about finally folding the company in 2002. And it's a great read if you want to learn how the business works in that country. And, you know, being in Japan, I was reading it well there, and like I'm in the places where he's talking about, and it was very surreal. And he talks about how selling the ring is the final stage before a company ends, and it's a great read, and I would implore anybody to go ahead and read that. Is there any other name that you want to go over?
Not off the top of my head as far as the first year or whatnot. You know, I had mentioned the previous one, Goito. He started off as a referee, and he ended up becoming one of the bookers. And like I mentioned in the last episode, he was one of the most influential bookers in wrestling. You know, he was great at kind of dealing with the politics of, you know, wrestlers wanting to go over and everything like that, as well as coming up with creative storylines. And you know, he's pretty noticeable. You know, for all during all the exploding ring matches, he's always the one wearing the big giant outfit, looking like he's, you know, has a
fallout
beekeeper
suit.
Outfit.
Yeah. I think that visual is what immediately hooks people, is seeing this ref in this blast suit. You know, it makes you think what's about to happen. Well, awesome. I just want to say this was great for me, because this is a lot of stuff I didn't know. And the whole reason why I wanted to reach out to Bahu and do this series was about 2 months ago or so. Dave Meltzer had a question on his show where someone asked, if Onita never injured his knee, what would the business be like? And Dave went through the butterfly effect of, well, there would have been no FMW, there would have been no ECW, there would have been no Attitude Era, and there probably would have been no deathmatch boom. I mean, it's one of the greatest butterfly effects to even try to think about. Mm-hmm. So this was super fun. If you're not busy, I was wondering if you could take a few minutes and go over some of the more recent news with Onita, the deathmatch companies. I know there's a lot of new news about the Super FMW or the Super Battle FMW League. If you wanted to just go over some of the bigger news that's gone on in the past few weeks.
Okay, so he had a match at the Shinkiba First Ring. He teamed up with Tamahiko Hashimoto, Raiden, and Tam Nakano, who is a model that has become a wrestler here recently, and she has adapted the same similar gimmick of the Great Tam. And with Onita saying that's his sister in storyline, and they took
is she the girl that wears the barbed wire bra?
No, that's someone else. That's okay. Someone different.
Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
No. But yeah, so they wrestled the match, at Shikiba First Ring, and afterwards, Onita ended up, pinning Onryo in the main event. And afterwards, he pretty much walked out of Shinkiba, and there's a river right there within walking distance. And so he walked out there with all the fans, coming with him, and he walked into the river, photographers and everything like that, taking pictures as if he's returning to the sea where he came from originally. So that was last week. He is going to be next month. He's going to be teaming up with Shikuza Nagoyo, who was, a famous Crush Gal wrestler in All Japan Women's Wrestling in the mid 80s. He's formed a partnership with her the last couple years or so, and they're going to be teaming up for the last time. And then later in the month, Onita is going to be taking on Masato Tanaka for the Super Fireworks heavyweight title in an exploding barbed wire match in Nagoya.
Great. Yeah, the whole Great Nia thing, I wish I could have been there, but I was at a Freedom show. That it's like Freedoms and Onita run at the same time constantly, and I've never gotten to see Onita because I buy my Freedoms tickets once I plan the trip and I find out about Onita much later. It's always a bummer. Just a couple last bits of indie deathmatch news from me. Jun Kasai has welcomed his kid. He had a daughter a couple days ago, so we wish him luck. And also at the Tokyo Deathmatch Carnival, he sliced his hand open so bad that they almost had to amputate one of his fingers. And he's going to be out for about 2 months, which is a bummer, but at least he gets to spend time with his family. So those are the big ones. And finally, just as a note, because me and Bahu had talked about Takeda and how he's he's maybe a bit of a danger to himself. His doctor posted a thing on Facebook saying that he's having some spinal issues, but with him being the Big Japan Deathmatch Champion and participating in the Big Japan Tag League all next month, I don't see him being able to take a break or anything. But I would say those are the big news stories. Bahu, do you have anything else you want to add before we close?
No, I think that's it.
Fantastic. Where can people find you?
BahuFNW.com, Twitter at BahuFNW, and my Instagram is BahuFNWWorld, where I just post random pictures every couple days or so.
It's awesome. If anybody wants to follow me, I'm actually doing a indie news coalition WordPress. You can find it at I can never say this. It's going to be at perorisuindymark.wordpress.com. And I just, twice a week, I just coalesce any news about Freedoms, Dove, BJW, anything that had, Basara, anything that has to do with the death matches or indie wrestling. And I just kind of coalesce all of the news that I find on Twitter and such. And that's about it. Thank you guys for listening. And we'll be back next week. Well, I don't know when we'll be back, but it'll be soon. And we'll talk about the first 2 or 3 years of FMW as it kicks off. So thank you so much, Brett.
All right, thank you.